Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard, and a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, I can't be a wizard. I mean, I'm just Harry.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus Wizarding World of Harry Potter retrospective series.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
The boy who lived, come to die.
Hosted by Brock.
Well, I'm sure we'd all be fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Stuart.
You won't last 2 seconds if he invades your mind.
And Arnie.
Why is it when something happens, it is always you three?
Believe me, Professor. I've been asking myself the same question for 6 years.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Now, there's absolutely nothing for you to worry about.
Tell me, has anyone ever believed you?
You told them not to worry?
Well, my philosophy is that worrying means you suffer twice.
Listener discretion is advised.
You wait till my father hears about this.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Do enjoy yourself, won't you? While you can.
Today we're talking about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 2, starring Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, Emma Watson, Helena Bonham Carter, Robbie Coltrane, Warwick Davis, Ralph Fiennes, Michael Gambon, John Hurt, Jason Isaacs, Gary Oldman, really? Alan Rickman, Maggie Smith, David Thewlis, Julie Walters, directed by David Yates. And not my daughter, you bitch. This is Brock.
And Stuart. Do not pity the dead, Brock. Pity the podcasters. And above all, those who edit the podcasts. This is Arnie.
Yeah, I was thinking about not my podcast, you bitch, instead. But I was like, I'll stay true to it. Welcome back to the final installment of the Harry Potter movies. This is part 2 of the Deathly Hallows. And I hope that moviegoers didn't come in here instead of seeing part 1. And we hope the podcast listeners have listened to our part 1 before you come into part 2 of us discussing the Deathly Hallows.
Actually, two of us hope you did skip part 1.
Yeah.
And I think that you might be able to come into part 2 without seeing part 1 and not miss a whole lot.
Yeah, I'm for that experience. But people did it because this is the biggest Harry Potter of them all. By a lot. Harry Potter movies in general in America make about $300 million. This one made almost $400 million in America. And when you add the international receipts, $1.5 billion for the finale. Everyone's got to come back. Even if you had given up on Harry Potter with movie 5, which is understandable, you're going to want to know how it all wrapped up. You're going to want to watch that last one.
So the idea that the movie studio had, even though they say it was because we did not want to short shrift the magical words of J.K. Rowling, but we all saw through that and said they want to keep milking this cow as long as they could. That decision for part 1 and part 2 paid off, right? You're saying part 2 did anyway. Did part 1 make anything in the neighborhood?
Yeah, it merely made $1 billion. So, you know, like, yes.
Wow.
Instead of making $1.5 billion, they made $2.5 billion. So, yes, from a fiscal standpoint, splitting it down the middle, that's probably exactly why so many other people took complicated books and said, we don't have to compromise. Make 2 movies, make double the money. And of course, the other thing that's going to contribute to the box office, this movie is in 3D, so you can charge a higher ticket rate.
And as I said last time, I did watch this in 3D, and this one had good 3D in it. I was surprised part 1 had such bad 3D, whereas this had such good 3D. But they had time to finish this. Part 1, they wanted out in 3D and just ran out of time. Here, they had a few extra months since they filmed these back-to-back, but then had extra time for effects and CGI post-conversion and what have you. Yes, this one, I recommend if you still have a TV that can do 3D or a projector and a way to get the 3D disc, it's worth it.
So, Arnie, give them the plot. Let's find out what happens at the conclusion.
Harry is on the hunt for the final three Horcruxes. After each is destroyed, Voldemort will be vulnerable and able to be killed. Harry thinks one may be stored in the Lestrange vault at the impenetrable Gringotts Bank. Harry hopes, with the help of Goblin Griphook, who Harry rescued last movie, they could sneak into and out of Gringotts. Griphook agrees on the condition that Harry gives the goblin the Sword of Gryffindor in exchange. Ron, Hermione, Harry, and Griphook sneak into the vault successfully, but then Griphook betrays the trio, stealing the sword, and the three teens barely escape. They did, however, get one more Horcrux from the vault. Though without the sword, they have no way to destroy it. Through a vision of Voldemort, Harry believes the next Horcrux is at Hogwarts. The three go to Hogsmeade, where they encounter Albaforth Dumbledore, cynical brother of deceased Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore. Albaforth helps sneak the three into Hogwarts, where Snape, Dumbledore's murderer, is now headmaster. Harry's arrival at the school sparks a mutiny as the staff overthrow Snape and start to form magical safeguards around the school. Outside the school, Voldemort has brought an army and a major battle begins. Inside the school, Harry must appeal to the ghost of Helena Ravenclaw, daughter of one of the founders of Hogwarts, for the location of the Horcrux. She tells him, and he retrieves the item, though he must fight Malfoy and his Slytherin friends in the process. Hermione and Ron go to the Chamber of Secrets in the school and retrieve teeth from the dead basilisk that lay there, as basilisk teeth are another item that can destroy a Horcrux. With the fourth and fifth Horcrux destroyed, only one remains, the snake named Nagini that is Voldemort's pet. Voldemort has the Elder Wand, the most powerful wand in the world, yet that wand is not granting him great power. He realizes the wand answers to the one who killed Dumbledore, which is Snape. Voldemort kills Snape so the wand will truly belong to him, the Dark Lord. Harry goes to Snape as he dies, and Snape gives Harry his tears. Harry puts them in the Pensieve in Dumbledore's office and sees Snape's memory. Snape knew Harry's mother, Lily, since they were both young children. Snape loved Lily, but his affections were not returned. As such, Snape hated the object of Lily's affection, James Potter. When Snape discovered Voldemort planned to kill the Potters, Snape went to Dumbledore and became a spy for Dumbledore in exchange for the Elder Wizard helping save Lily's life. Dumbledore is too late, though, so Snape commits to helping protect Lily's son, Harry. In the memories, they also see that Dumbledore had been poisoned by the first Horcrux. He had, at most, a year to live. Dumbledore convinced a reluctant Snape to kill him to prevent Malfoy from becoming a murderer. When Snape killed Dumbledore last year, it was a mercy killing at the headmaster's request. Finally, in the memory is one last thing. Voldemort accidentally created a seventh Horcrux, Harry himself. In order for Voldemort to die, Harry must also die. Harry goes alone to face Voldemort and is instantly hit with a killing curse. But Harry isn't killed. He goes into a realm where he can have one last conversation with Dumbledore, who reveals the curse didn't kill Harry, but it killed the piece of Voldemort inside of Harry. Harry plays dead and Voldemort takes the presumed corpse back to Hogwarts as a prize. There, Harry reveals his ruse, Neville Longbottom finds the Sword of Gryffindor and uses it to kill the snake Nagini, then Harry and Voldemort duel, and Harry wins. Voldemort is dead. We then jump 19 years into the future. Ron and Hermione are married with many children. Ron is married to Hermione, and they too have children. The friends are at the train station, sending their children off to Hogwarts for their own magical education, as credits roll.
You know you're starting off on better footing when we, you know, scene one, Dobby's grave. I'm loving it. Okay. Let's leave that stuff behind. I had a lot of negativity about him and many things in the last movie.
Stuart, just drinking those millennial tears.
I'm just ready to just bury all of that, and let's just go forward into what's essentially the climax. We've got about, what, 250 pages to cover here? We're getting to the good stuff of the book by being able to just launch right into it. They got maybe, what, one other Horcrux to find outside of Hogwarts, but afterwards it's back to the school, which is where I feel like this series has always found its strength.
It's also one of the shorter movies. We're only looking at 2 hours and 10 minutes, a lot shorter than last week.
Which is interesting, considering that last week was 2.5 hours and covered much more of the book. I love how this movie starts, not with a big giant action scene, but it starts with them at the house talking to Ollivander and Griphook. And it's kind of a nice, calm way to start. I mean, we have that shot of Snape on top of the school and all that kind of stuff, but it really, the first big scene is Warwick Davis as this goblin. I'd never seen Warwick Davis act. I never seen him have this much presence before. I thought he did a really great job through that makeup.
Obviously, you have not seen Leprechaun in the Hood.
I have not. I have seen a few leprechauns, not Leprechaun in the Hood. I will take that back. I have not seen him with this much presence. I'm not saying he doesn't have bigger presence elsewhere. I thought he did quite well, and the whole thing with It's Complicated was a nice touch. That whole scene played so, so well, and the next scene with John Hurt, you expect that. Nothing against Warwick Davis, but I've seen John Hurt do quite a lot of big performances before, but both these scenes played really well to me.
I want to say I lost Warwick Davis under the voice and the makeup here, though. I couldn't tell it was him. I wanted to look it up and make sure that that was the goblin he played in the first movie again, that it was him. It could have been a different actor. He gave such a different performance.
Why is the goblin here? Why did they have him locked up in the basement?
Well, they say, why do the Malfoys have him locked up in the basement?
That's a good question.
That's a great question. I don't remember why.
Okay. All right. Just want to be clear that it's unclear. That remains in this. But yeah, they got a goblin here. He's connected to the bank. And before you know it, they're figuring out that they need to... Why do they know that the Horcrux is in the bank?
Because Bellatrix, in the last movie, freaked out that the sword was taken from her vault. And she was worried something else was taken from her vault. But that's not entirely clear as it is in the book.
So, in this movie, looking at this scene, all they know is Bellatrix was freaking out, and she has a vault, and so they want to go to that vault, which is virtually impenetrable, in the hopes of seeing something and going, yep, that must be the Horcrux.
But Harry has this, like, spidey sense around Horcruxes, apparently. He can tell what will be a Horcrux when he's next to it.
But he doesn't know he's a Horcrux, so...
Right. He doesn't know reason is because he's part of that whole thing. Right. Exactly. The souls speak to each other.
But it leads to a great scene with the break into Gringotts. I gotta say, you want to start this movie off with a bang, a nice action scene with a lot of tension. Gringotts has been built up since the first movie as this impenetrable, nothing can get in, get out of there. That's why the Sorcerer's Stone was kept there for so long. And I'm very game, and I love what Helena Bonham Carter is doing here as Hermione. You know, you forget that Bonham Carter can sometimes act normal. I always just think of her as crazy female Tim Burton.
Beyond that, I even pointed it out to my daughter, who I was watching this movie with. I've watched all of these movies with her as part of our Now Playing retrospective, and it's been really fun for me to do that. I pointed out to her, look at the body language that Helena Bonham Carter is doing. She is standing like a teenage girl. She's walking differently. Her head is askew differently. Her eyes are not on fire like they are when she's playing Bellatrix. This woman was great. All these little touches and how uncomfortable she was in the clothes.
The fall in the big heel was funny.
All of these things that Helena Bonham Carter is bringing to it, it's just a masterclass. She was so great as Hermione, it was worth mentioning to her, my daughter, about just all the nuances. And so when you have that voice come out of her, it's clearly not the same voice. It's Emma Watson's voice. It's a lot of fun. It plays so well. It plays so much comedy. But at the same time, when they're in the bank, it's tension. It's a lot of tension going on because the goblins aren't buying it. The whole scene plays so well. Bravo to Helena Bonham Carter.
I did laugh at Good Morning. I'll give them that. I'm not into the goofiness. I've already said last movie, they do this polyjuice potion. This is the third time now that they're doing this. I thought I was told these stories got more intense as they go along. This is still kind of a goofy break-in scene. I don't think it's that tense, Brock, but I laughed. I was charmed by it. I think of the three in Deathly Hallows, if you think about breaking into the ministry and the chase to the safe house, this is probably my favorite one.
But to get in, obviously the goblins have been tipped off to Bellatrix losing her wand. I mean, that's made explicit in the book, but here you can get it because they ask for Bellatrix's wand. And Harry does the Imperius curse. Now, we're told that's an unforgivable curse. That's like one of the three things that could bring about, I guess, the wizard death penalty. Yet Harry will do it several times here in Gringotts, and never suffer any blowback whatsoever, so you can do unforgivable curses if you feel like it?
Well, or when Hitler's taken over everything. I mean, like, it's critical times. The rules don't apply anymore. The people that are the rule makers are the bad guys.
And not to mention, of course, in a few minutes from now, all of those goblins are dead anyway. So it's not like someone's going to tell on him.
That makes it so much better that he's involved in goblin massacre.
I'm not saying it's better. I'm just saying it's convenient.
You understand. I mean, I'm poking fun at it, while at the same time, seriously have a problem by saying these three things are things only evil people do, and Harry does one, and he's never pulled to the dark side.
Well, yeah, but he tries to do it in a previous movie also. I remember Bellatrix screams at him, "You have to mean it, boy." So it's not the first time Harry has tried to do that. But I digress. My issue with this, and I brought it up on our Books and Nachos show, is how Polyjuice Potion works at all in Gringotts, considering that it's supposed to be the highly secure bank. It makes sense to me the Imperius Curse works, because that's an unforgivable curse, not expecting that to happen. But they even have a waterfall down below that wipes away all magic. So you would think they would have that up top, like a metal detector or something. You would have to walk through this waterfall, and you magically become dry afterwards, so all enchantments would wipe off. Why isn't that upstairs is what I'm asking. So it doesn't make much sense to me from that technical aspect, but to break into a bank, I guess, is the best way to do it.
Here's the thing I like about the whole Harry Potter series and what Rowling has done. Growing up, I'd watch a lot of Star Trek, specifically The Next Generation. We reviewed those movies. And in one episode, Geordi would be like, "Oh, we're facing this problem, and I need to invert a tachyon pulse out the sensor dish, and we're gonna fix this." And then 2 weeks later, they have a similar problem, and we're like, "Why don't you just invert the tachyon pulse like you did two episodes ago? You seem to have forgotten that." Well, here, Rowling is very good at saying, "I've introduced shapeshifting, and so this would be a go-to for that."
And also, these kids have used it before, and they'll use it again because that's what they know, because they're kids.
It just helps with universe building and verisimilitude.
Sure, that makes sense from that aspect. Did you guys enjoy the Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom railway car stuff? Did you enjoy the dragon, the sad-looking dragon down there? All of this stuff, the multiplying vault, all this entire scene has so many different elements to it. It's a huge CGI scene with the backgrounds and the dragon and the multiplying treasure. Was it bringing you in, or was it just overwhelming you?
Neither. It was okay. Again, this is not the tone I'm looking for, particularly now that we're at the very last installment. I'm wanting Voldemort all the time. This is just a little too cutesy, but it was fine. What's going on here? Whenever they touch one of the cups, they multiply, or whenever they move? I don't know. It's a fun visual to see them in an ever-growing pile of gold.
Yeah, I don't feel that this movie explains the repeating magic objects very well, but you just go with it because you see what's happening. You figure it's some kind of trap. How Harry knows which cup it is one thing. But again, I'm just struck when the lead goblin who Harry had used the Imperius curse on is just standing there because he's cursed and the dragon breathes fire on him. And I'm like, Harry caused this guy's death. Now, we are told that the dragon is abused. Hermione goes on and on about dragon rights, and that's horrible how this dragon is treated. So because of that, is it okay that Harry caused this goblin's death?
He would have died anyway, seen later, but yeah, no. Maybe Ron did it? I can't remember who actually cast the curse on him.
I think only Harry does Imperius curses.
Okay, I just know that that poor guy looks up so doe-eyed and he gets crispy. I felt bad for him.
I know it's played for a laugh, but I'm trying to take this world seriously. And I'm like, Dude, you just killed a goblin. And then their escape is going to kill dozens of goblins and other bank patrons. Anybody who just came to get some cash that day, dead.
Not to mention the rooftops of London, right? Or wherever they are in Diagon Alley, because the dragon keeps crawling all over it because it has trouble flying because it hasn't flown in many, many years. Sure, property damage alone is terrible here.
I didn't think all those deaths were related to the dragon busting out. I thought it had to do with the fact that Voldemort came and killed them.
That's true. But he's making the point that at least one goblin died because of these kids.
Many goblins died because of these kids. Because when they get on the dragon and release him, that dragon is like a flamethrower, just burning up everything in its path.
And the goblins who didn't get killed in the escape of the dragon got killed when Voldemort came, including Griphook, who was still there with the sword. And that ties up that in a tidy little bow. The sword disappears again and returns to where it rightfully should be, which brings up the whole, well, if they switched the sword and the fake sword, blah, 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 why wouldn't the sword disappear anyway? But that's okay. It doesn't really matter. We want it to disappear here so it can come into play later on in the movie.
Yeah, I want to go back to Hogwarts. I'm done with this. Let's get on
right
with the actual battle. We're pretty much going to watch a climax for the next 90 minutes. Everything that we're about to see is really the big ending of the book.
Incredible. I mean, that's what I want. You know that after all 7 movies of build-up, I want a 90-minute climax. We're going to spend a little bit of time with Dumbledore's brother. Very little time compared to what it was in the book, though.
Yay! I'm glad. Just cut all this stuff out. It really doesn't matter.
So what's interesting is he has more lines, Kieran Hines has more lines as Ablefort Dumbledore than the majority of the cast that I'd read at the top of this podcast. And because I read the cast list, he's not even on there, but he's clearly credited. He does a great job here with the part. I found him to be, it's hardly recognizable too. We've seen this actor do 1,000 things. But yeah, he's a big data dump, and he's basically a means to an end to get back to Hogwarts with the portrait. And that wonderful scene with Neville coming out of the portrait, all that's great. I love that so much. But his bitterness and the sister and his relationship with his brother is severely truncated from what it was in the books.
It didn't play in the book for me. I'm glad that they did not include this. They tried to show a darker Dumbledore, and it just didn't. Like, in the end, it was like maybe he neglected her, maybe a spark from a wand hit her, but no one's sure who. Yeah, who cares? Let's not do that.
I don't think they set up Grindelwald enough that they can just make a whole movie about him in a couple weeks, but okay.
Yeah, they can, because they'll be starting anew. That's what they should do. They should not try to set up the prequel while they're doing 2 different quests here. Again, these choices are right. Let's get through this. So Dumbledore has a brother. He hides him out. The place is now overrun with Death Eaters. Alarms are going off. It will be impossible for these kids to get in there. Except that, yeah, there's some cool painting that lets them in. And now all the kids are being called before Snape.
But it also should be noted that, unlike in the book and in the first movie, Harry just tells Ablefort about the Horcruxes and all sorts of stuff that seems to break rules. At this point, Harry doesn't seem to care that. I was really surprised he was just open with Ablefort, a person he doesn't even know.
That's a good point. I mean, last movie, everybody's like, what are you doing? I can't tell you. I can't tell you.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe because this is Dumbledore's brother, you just trust him more because he's a Dumbledore?
And he was helping them. I mean, it gets mentioned that he was the one on the other side of the mirror shard watching them. And he was the one that sent Dobby to go rescue them at the end. So he's an ally. And was that working for you, Harry, not telling anybody? Like, yeah, you might as well have. Like, he does. Like, let me just get all the class involved because we suck as a trio trying to find these things.
But in the book, he tells Neville about the snake. In the movie, he doesn't. He tells Hermione and Ron about the snake.
Which I thought was for sure to give Ron something useful to do.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there bugged. You're going to take away Neville's moment, but Ron needs to do something.
But Ron doesn't kill the snake. Neville still kills the snake. So what's the point? Why change that? It plays here in the movie just fine, but from a standpoint of you're not telling anybody, you're telling somebody, the only person you tell is Neville, and you don't tell Neville. It's weird. Anyway, they go to school. Harry's treated like a hero when he comes back in, when he goes into that room requirement. I loved Ron's reaction when Ginny was happy to see Harry, not him. That was pretty funny and good character stuff. And Snape's watching everyone march. There's an interesting thing I want to mention here. There's a deleted scene. Snape gives the speech to the school. Everyone's marching into the Great Hall. And there's a deleted scene, a very brief scene, where there's a close-up of Ginny in that marching, and Harry's already there with her, and they're holding hands as they march in. That would completely ruin the reveal of Harry when he steps out and confronts Snape. I'm really glad they cut that out. It's a nice little moment for Ginny and him, but it does not work for the movie. I'm really glad they made that decision.
Yeah, I understand why you'd film it. I understand why you'd not use it.
My favorite showdown. I don't care about no Harry versus Voldemort. I love McGonagall versus Snape. This was brilliant. I just love the idea of Maggie Smith is going to pull out her wand and finally do some shit here.
And much to the applause of the students, I love when Harry comes through the portrait and sees all his friends and the Harry Potter theme comes on. Great use of that music. When they use it again after McGonagall sends Snape going away, I didn't like it so much. I thought that was overkill. But the music here overall is, we didn't talk about it a minute ago, but when they're flying with the dragon, the music was beautiful. Like, a lot of the musical choices in this movie are really, really strong. I just thought this one cue wasn't. But what a great moment for Maggie Smith, stepping in and protecting Potter, and then says, it's good to see you, Potter, and lock up the Slytherins, and all that stuff for McGonagall, just stepping up, taking charge, loving it.
Okay, lock up the Slytherins. If this is the House of Slytherin, that they are all so evil, they're like wanting to give up Potter. I know Pansy Parkinson, who I know more from the books than these movies, but the face looks somewhat familiar. I think she might have been on the train with Malfoy last movie, or part six. But if just she said, give up Harry, then I could get it. But given that all the Slytherins now need to be marched to the dungeon because they're Nazi sympathizers, it really does get back to Stuart's original point of, why do you have an evil house?
And why are you surprised when they do evil? Yeah.
Fair enough. And when they all break out later, somehow Malfoy apparates to get them out. And what the hell was that? So again, with inconsistencies, maybe when Dumbledore left, the no apparating into Hogwarts rule went out the window too.
Well, by the time that was happening, the Death Eaters had sieged the castle, and I think probably most of the magical safeguards were down at that point.
Yeah, we're seeing that, McGonagall is now head of the school. I guess she remains so? Is that, according to the book, she takes over? This is her new position, but she's the one that's calling the gargoyles out, getting people to create the bubble around the place, and she's really taking charge.
She's having fun. I love that she brings those gargoyles to life and then's like, I always wanted to use that spell to... That's the Weasley mom she's hanging around with, right?
It took me a long time to figure that out. I was like, is that the nurse? Who is that lady?
Yeah, because in this scene you have Sprout is not there and Trelawney is not there, but they're in later in the movie. But you have Slughorn and Flitwick helping her with the spells. Where the hell was Trelawney? Maybe only had Emma Thompson for a day or...
Ding, ding, ding. Gotta be, right? Yeah. So, Horcruxes. We got, all right. I'm gonna call it a crown. What is this word they're using to describe it?
Diadem.
Diadem? Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Dictionary that one.
I like how they were using the characters they have. The complaint we had last time of new characters, blah, 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 blah. Luna helps Harry figure out the spirit of... Ravina Ravenclaw needs to be talked to, not Cho Chang.
She says talk to a ghost. Was I the only one who thought Moaning Myrtle was going to be the answer here? I don't know where this new ghost, the Gray Lady, came from, but I thought maybe they wouldn't introduce all kinds of new subplots this late in the game, and if you needed to know a ghost, Moaning Myrtle might be your person.
Yeah, but you want Ravenclaw to do something here, right? That's the point.
What house was Myrtle in? She could be a Ravenclaw.
I don't know, but I do know that the Grey Lady was mentioned in the books, in many previous books, but of course, Peeves and other ghosts was cut out of these movies.
I also thought John Cleese might show up, if not Moaning Myrtle, but I didn't expect them to actually find a brand new ghost, which I don't feel they explain who this person is very well.
Right. It's much more explained in the book, and again, because of the characters were in previous books, or at least the Bloody Baron was, and mentioned in previous books, it all makes sense in the book. Here, she's a new character, another ghost.
Did you get, from the movie, did you get this is the daughter of Ravenclaw who started that house? Because I've replayed this scene twice, and I do not think it's in there.
She does not say she stole the crown, right?
No, she says she took it from her mother.
Well, there you go. Then, yes.
But who's her mother?
Ravina Ravenclaw.
But she doesn't say that.
Oh, okay.
And who's Ravina Ravenclaw? Have they even said that name?
I agree. I'm not getting anything out of this ghost moment, but there's a lot of other things going on. Fortunately, what Harry Potter is doing is the least interesting thing in this movie. There's a whole lot of, like, hordes, like, at the gates. We see Voldemort ready to command, and I think someone wants to tell him, maybe we should wait until we've rescued our own, right? I think that's what they're trying to apply. And of course, Voldemort, there's nobody that he's going to put above his own needs. We're charging now.
There's some good moments here when they try to shoot the shields down with the bridge, then Neville knocks the bridge down. That's some good stuff right there. That's a lot of fun.
given Neville something to do. I really love the evolution of that character over 8 movies.
Completely agree. That really pays off well here. He has some really great moments and more coming up.
He's a lot taller, too, now. I mean, like, almost unrecognizable.
And then Hermione and Ron go to the Chamber of Secrets to get basilisk fangs. Plays a tiny bit differently than the book, but that's okay.
5 years later, they left that corpse just sitting there.
And there's no rats biting down that thing. It's, anyway.
Something ate the meat off those bones.
Something had to. And because tons of bones of rats and other vermin were down there, that Tabasco's been eating for all those years, as we saw in that movie. But the big moment down there, of course, is finally their kiss, their big giant kiss. All the behind-the-scenes stuff on these two, you know, kissing my brother and things like that kind of stuff. We're really anxious for them to do it.
I love on the 20th anniversary reunion, this is another clip the millennials are sharing on the TikToks.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I'm this Gen Xer in there. But the scene of them asking Rupert Grint and Emma Watson about the kiss, and Emma Watson was like, oh, that was horrible. And then they just cut to Rupert Grint's face of, oh, shit.
Yeah, but for my money, he seems to kiss much better than Daniel Radcliffe does on screen. I mean, it just seems that it was much more natural to kiss than Hermione and Harry shared in the last movie.
And they have the special effects to help cover it up, too. The chamber's filling with water. Yeah, it's a nice moment.
They've been teasing that one since movie 3.
Yes.
So it's like, it's finally come there, and good for them for finally doing it. It paid off well. It didn't just have to happen. I think it happened at the right moment.
So for all the characters that we're seeing return here, we see Cho Chang, Dean Thomas is back, we're seeing Seamus.
Who?
Other characters.
I know. I'm just making a point that we really never knew who they were.
Lavender Brown, a whole bunch of people have come back.
Yeah, they actually got the actress of Cho Chang back. I don't know what else she was doing, but that was kind of fun.
But we're not seeing is Grop, the giant who Hagrid brought back. We were under the impression that he'd be there, and he's in the book, but they brought him in the movie. They made a big deal having him in the movie for whatever reason, and he's not here fighting the trolls, because those are not giants. Those are trolls.
Oh, I thought they were giants.
No, giants are much bigger than that. These all look like trolls. So they cut out all the giants that were in the book.
I really thought those were giants. I thought Voldemort had giants and giant spiders and everything we've ever heard of at his command.
Right, but since we haven't had other giants before, they stuck with trolls. They all look like trolls to me, and we didn't have Grop, which makes zero sense considering you've made a big deal of not cutting him out of the other movie. So all these things they decided to cut out, and we had to figure out how to deal with it in part one of this movie, and they don't bring Grop back here. It blows my mind.
It's fine. He was awful. It was a terrible CGI effect, and nobody's missing him.
The centaurs never come back either.
Correct. Centaurs were in the book. Could have been nice here. Obviously, they have a lot of special effects going on here. The Hogwarts is clearly a CGI Hogwarts. There are pieces and parts of it, but there are green screens everywhere. You can completely tell that. And that's fine. It looks great. The battle is raging everywhere. There's extras all over the place. I guess they just didn't have time or money or whatever to put in centaurs, giants, and grops.
Yeah, those things look bad.
For my money, they're trying to do the Return of the King ending.
Yeah.
When you see the hordes stampeding with the, I guess, their trolls and everything towards the castle. So yes, I would have liked to see centaurs and Grop and everything come back. The bigger the battle, the better. That was the best part of Return of the King, was the huge, immense battle with all those creatures and all those everything. And so the more you throw in here, I would have enjoyed it. But that said, I'm not missing it. The fact that you're saying this during the watching, I'm enjoying what the battle is bringing. Yes, this stuff would have added more flavor to the stew, but I was enjoying what we had.
Yeah, what we have is great. I'm agreeing with you there. It's really great to see it, and it plays wonderful, and I'm able to follow mostly what everything is going on.
Why does Harry find the tiara? He goes into the Room of Requirements, and just all of a sudden, he just is this spidey sense. He can just tingle, and I just know it's under these ropes.
Yes. In the book, it's out and about, and he remembers seeing something like it when he was in there in movies 6, book 6. But here, he just has his spidey sense telling him that he'll know it when he finds it. It's not entirely clear, but that's the impression I was getting, that his piece of the soul of Voldemort is leading him to the other piece of the Voldemort. soul. That's how I'm reading it. What's interesting here is that Malfoy is also in there, and he brings in Blaze and Goyle. And I had mentioned earlier that someone was replaced a couple of episodes ago. Here, we have Blaze and Goyle instead of Crab and Goyle. There's the actor who played Crab was arrested for marijuana possession or something. So he was not asked back.
And this is, again, Draco proving that he's just not capable, right? You could say that he has a heart, or you could say that he's just a coward. I'm tending towards the latter. It's not that he really is ever patching it up with Harry Potter or sees his side.
In fact, he goes and gets two goons to attack Harry Potter.
And his friend keeps egging him on to hurt Harry Potter, and Harry Potter's like, how come you didn't tell on me?
Yeah.
It was an interesting scene that Draco bothers to go because he wants his wand back. It's weak, but I like how it plays out. I love the fiend fire. I love the rumor requirement. The set design is amazing. The whole scene is great, so I'll go along with it.
In this movie, it had hit me when Ron and Hermione kissed. And I don't know why I hadn't thought of this directly before. Maybe I said it in part one. But Harry Potter's our Luke Skywalker, who won't have a girlfriend major player. And we've got Hermione as Princess Leia and Ron as Han Solo. And so when Ron on his own goes chasing after those guys screaming, I know how that scene's going to end. I've seen Star Wars. It's going to end with him screaming and running back just like Han Solo did. And I'm not disappointed. But it's not just because the other three overpowered him. It's because they've set off a raging inferno that nobody can stop. It was fun.
It's not the Phoenix, right? At one point it looked like the Dumbledore bird, but it's just some other kind of flame monster.
Yeah, it's called Fiend Fire that Goyle lit and tried to use but could not control it. They have a scene of him trying to stop it and he can't control it and it gets out of control. I think what you're referring to is at the end of the scene when the three heads of Voldemort are in flames, right? Because it kind of looks like heads are coming out of the flames. It's not a phoenix, it's something completely different. It's evil spell fire.
No, but it turns into a firebird too. It's almost like a Vegas show of shaping the fire into these various forms.
I didn't see a bird, but okay, I'll take your word for it. I thought the effect was good. The fire looked good. The set was really neat. I liked how, I'm not sure if you guys noticed it, this is not my first time watching this movie, but there seemed to be a lot of props from previous Harry Potter movies in there, and one of them was the giant chess pieces from Sorcerer's Stone.
Oh, didn't catch that.
That was one thing I thought was really fun. I'm sure there's tons of other stuff in there if you look closely to see whether it's stuff they have from previous movies.
Okay, so they're wizards. I know they're working on potions, apparating, and all of that. But basic math, why do they think there's only one Horcrux left? They're like, the snake is the last one, but that would only be six.
Because he split his soul in seven pieces, so he kept one of the seven pieces and then made six Horcruxes.
So the last movie, I should say two movies ago now, because this is part two, what they needed from Slughorn was how many Horcruxes was the last piece that Dumbledore needed. He suspected Horcruxes, and now he knows there are six Horcruxes, and then Voldemort's the seventh. And then we learn soon that Harry was an unintentional Horcrux, so his soul was split into eight instead of seven.
All right, and just to run it down so everyone's got this, the Horcruxes were a ring, a diary, a locket, a cup, and a tiara. What am I missing?
The snake.
Okay.
What I liked about this also is they stab it with the fang, and then they kick it in to finish off the Horcrux. I thought that was a really great scene for Ron. Ron's bravery is coming through in spades here. Hermione keeps reacting that Ron's stepping up and thinking of things, and Ron's really raising to the moment just like Neville is. It's kind of cool.
I don't know that I always believe Hermione when she runs up to Harry. Ron had this great idea, and it was totally Ron's idea. I didn't give him this idea. Ron came up with this idea. It's like when my wife says, we should have pizza for dinner, and I go, no. And then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, we should have pizza for dinner.
What's interesting also, I mentioned other people come back. We see a quick scene of Greyback biting Lavender Brown. It kind of implies that Lavender dies here, or maybe she'll become a werewolf. But it's not entirely clear. But that poor girl who was snogging Ron in movie six is dead there on the ground from a werewolf bite.
I couldn't tell who that was.
But no, this is all exciting. It's moving fast. I'm having a great time. It's really a blast going on here. And then it's not going to let up, even though we're going to now get to Snape's death. That is more impactful than I thought it was. Kudos to Alan Rickman. Always a great performer. I've seen bad things with him in it, but I've never seen him be bad. And he kills it here for his death scene.
Yeah, he's good, but it's also staged well. I mean, just the way that they shoot it, Harry's experiencing it as the snake attack in silhouette against the door. All of that, yeah, it does play well.
The thumping against the wall of the door, that was awesome. That was really well done. It was brutal, but you didn't see it. You could visualize it because of the thump, thump, thump. Really well done.
I mean, his death scene could be corny as hell with the look me in the eyes and take them, take my tears. I think it honestly plays better with Alan Rickman than it does on the page.
I think the page plays better, but I do like they changed the line a little bit. In the book, it's just look at me, and they spell it out here, you have your mother's eyes. So kind of a precursor to what Harry will see of Snape's memories in The Pensieve. So I thought the scenes played really well. I thought the resonance hit home big time. I would have kind of liked, if they could have done it, was to film a lot of these scenes while those movies were taking place. Right? Clearly, because they were not on the sets of all those different places because they didn't want to rebuild, say, Dumbledore's office or whatever. So it would have been kind of cool if they knew the end before they filmed it, that they could have filmed it as they went on the different sets so it would look more like there were real memories. If you have all these people coming back, would it also been nice to have familiar places also?
Okay. I almost feel like this scene could have gone a little slower because you don't get the nuances the book is going to explain. For example, that's a Dursley there. That's the sister of Lily. We never really saw them together. It would have been nice to tie that in some way. And it passes by. We get the point. The point is that Snape's a lover boy, unrequited. But it would have been a fun way to tie in some of the supporting characters.
There's something here about a boy joining a terrorist organization because he's an incel. But Snape eventually comes back to the good side. I thought it was touching that Petunia was included at all in these scenes. You know, if you're paying attention, you get who it is. And sure, there could be more of it. But let's not slow down this movie that's been moving at a great pace so far.
So if Snape was the one that created the dough, was he helping Harry when he found the sword? What was with that dough?
Exactly right. So that the Patronus is, because Lily is the doe is, and James is a stag, right? So that makes sense why it's a doe. And that moment with Always is just a beautiful moment. And yes, Snape was actually helping Harry. How he knew Harry was there, I don't know, but it's just a conceit.
Okay.
So Snape had the sword of Gryffindor, threw it into a lake, sent a doe to get Harry, and then probably stood there and watched Harry almost drown and just sat there. You stupid idiot, can't even swim. I've led you to the sword. Oh, good. I'm glad your friend showed up to save your dumb ass.
I don't know if he was there. And I don't know what a Patronus is. I don't know if you're literally there when you let it go. Or
you cast it out of your wand and it just goes a very short distance.
Well, now, wait a second. In the last movie, in part one, Kinsey's Patronus, well, it doesn't really look like a Patronus. It looks like a ball of light. It's supposed to be a Patronus and he talks from it. Here, I think in the book, they hear footsteps and it is cast. So Snape is there and sends the doe out. But in the movie, which we're talking about, I'm pretty sure there's no implication that Snape is anywhere near there. So this Patronus travels there just to lead him to where the sword was dropped off. I don't understand why it was under the water. I don't understand how Snape knew where they were. All of that's not explained, but it's a nice moment.
And another nice moment is Harry is going to accept his fate. He has had this little snitch thing that I couldn't figure out how this was going to play into things. But because he did swallow it the first time, it has a sense memory of his mouth. And when he puts it inside, it opens up and there is the resurrection stone.
Yeah, I open at the close is not a riddle worthy of Paul Dano. I'll just say that.
So we get yet another chance for Harry to interact with his parents, but this time also we have Lupin and Sirius, and I like how they demonstrate that they're just kind of like specters, kind of like the portraits, I guess, but not quite ghosts. I'm not really sure what corporeal form they take, but I do like all of these moments, and what's interesting is they say, we'll be there with you till the end, and then he drops the stone so they're not with him anymore.
No, but she points at her heart. It's,
right.
We'll be in your heart. You don't need the stone. I don't know what this scene added other than trying to tug at the heartstrings.
Yeah, I think that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to build up to the idea. It wouldn't be satisfying for him to just walk out into the forest and get shot. We needed to have him accept the fate of death.
And Lily also says the word always like Snape did, which was kind of a nice little thing. So Harry gets sent to the world between worlds, which reminded me a little bit of the end of The Matrix 2 and the beginning of Pirates of the Caribbean 3.
And it's a train station, just like Neo went to a subway station.
Yeah, so it's very familiar.
And there's a crazy bearded guy in both ones.
And Harry has perfect eyesight here. No glasses.
Didn't even look like him. He had better hair, too.
Did he have a scar? I don't remember. But all his injuries are gone. He's clean there. And this is better here than in the novel with the personification of the hurt and injured soul of Voldemort that's under the table or whatever. That's much clearer because it looks like the bit of Voldemort from the end of the Goblet of Fire before he becomes a person again. He looks at that little thing he was, that little piece of him. And so here it reminded me of that, and it was much clearer that it was the soul, the piece of the soul that has been killed out of Harry's head. And then Harry has a conversation with Dumbledore because we need Dumbledore to have a data dump with Harry. It is a Harry Potter movie after all. But I liked Gambit in this scene, and I liked how it was very clear that this all was in Harry's head, and then they finally call it out. All of that played well for me, and I thought Gambit was full of life that we rarely got to see of him. It reminded me of the end of Azkaban, how his personality shone through there. It came across here as well. I liked him much better here than I have in other previous data dump scenes. I thought he did quite well. It's a weird scene, though, and there's no denying it. It kind of comes or seems like out of the blue, but it's the last respite before the grand finale.
I liked the scene with him and Dumbledore. It was fun. In some movies, it could play as too much. Here, I think it played just right. And I do think that they needed a better goodbye than finding a fake locket. I think it's a nice send-off for Dumbledore and allowing Harry to now go forth for the first time in his life, free of prophecies, curses, no Horcrux in him. He's his own man now. It's a rebirth, if you will.
And they're dragging his corpse to Hogwarts to try and get recruits. Your chosen one is dead.
They didn't bring back Grop, but this is the first time we're seeing Hagrid. He has to carry the body.
I wonder if this is the first time Tom Riddle has seen Hagrid since the Chamber of Secrets issue 50 years ago. Anyway, this is the first time we see Hagrid since part one. He's there tied up in the forest, whatever. And I liked Ralph Fiennes when he was mocking Neville. That was kind of fun to watch, and Neville had a nice moment. Was standing up to him, and I like how the Malfoys walked away. All of this stuff plays for me. All these character beats completely play and really are a nice build-up to the final battle. Right after that, of course, is the big scene with Molly and Bellatrix, which I felt played better in the novel, but certainly it has the payoff moment that people were looking for with Molly's famous line, which I quoted at the beginning of this podcast. Not my daughter, you bitch. But in the book, I think there's like three or four people teaming up against her. But Molly certainly has her moment here, and they both play well.
In the book, it didn't hit me that such a minor character killed Bellatrix. But I guess since one of her sons lost an ear and another one of her sons lost his life, she needed to do something. It kind of goes back to what Stuart said on Books and Nachos about mothers do everything.
Yeah, and also she was attacking Ginny. So that's when she steps in. What you just said about the two sons, and then she's not going to risk losing her daughter, too.
I feel like it's easier in the movie to understand how everyone has a moment. In the book, maybe I was just racing to the end, some of these things escaped me. But yeah, Neville getting the kill in, I mean, I recognized it in the book, but I just think it's more satisfying. I just think it's a better ending visually. Since this is such a visual fight, it just plays better than that prose.
Not to mention that Harry can't do this alone, so all of these people contribute with value to and have their moments, and we see them have that. It would have been weird if, say, Hermione even defeated Bellatrix, even though those are two more main characters than Molly is. But they certainly make Molly step up and have a great moment there, and what we're saying about her kids already being hurt and she sacrificed so much for her own, it's a good scene. The finale with Harry and Voldemort flying all over the place and the Elder Wand not working for Voldemort and him disintegrating. I think in the book, they lay his body in a separate chamber in Hogwarts. Here he disintegrates, which I think is a much better choice, considering that all the rest of his souls and Horcruxes get destroyed and blow apart. Having him also blow apart makes much more sense, and also is much more exciting visually.
Of course, Voldemort was sending a killing curse. Harry was just doing like a stunning curse that was the red, whatever the red curse was, and it kills Voldemort so that Harry wasn't out there murdering in a duel for the death. But I like all of this. I feel like it's still very exciting. It ends the way you know it's going to end. You don't think it's going to end with Voldemort triumphant, but it's a very satisfying conclusion. I'm sick just in general of the energy streams that meet in the middle and cancel each other out, but this movie's 12 years old, so I'll grant it that.
And I'm relieved. I mean, again, it seemed to be part of the playbook that we take all of these nasty characters and make them soft at the end. I'm glad that Ralph Fiennes remains the grinning, ghoulish monster. I really didn't want a redemption for him. I was hoping that he would die hated, and he is.
Yeah, we have other people getting redeemed. We have the Malfoys making different choices. We have Snape showing his true colors. Those redemption stories or partial redemption stories are happening. The people who are bad to the bone, like Bellatrix and Voldemort, do not have a way back, and that's satisfying for all of us. Speaking of people who don't change, did you notice after the battle and after Harry wins and all that, did you catch that Filch was already cleaning up?
Yes.
Yes, that was hysterical.
That was great.
You know, I figured somebody's just going to come by and ripero, and
his work's all for nothing anyway, but man, I wouldn't want to be the janitor that day.
One thing they did change from the book for the movie was Harry snaps the Elder Wand in half and throws it off the bridge instead of repairing his own wand and retiring the Elder Wand. That was an interesting choice, because now Harry has no wand. He doesn't have one.
Somebody will get him a wand, I'm pretty sure.
And then we jump 19 years later, and let me tell you, the amount of suspense I felt while that title card 19 years later was there, because I'm like, what are they going to do? Are they going to have different actors? Are they going to take these teenagers and try to age them up?
Because either way, I think it's a bad decision.
And then I see these kids aged up, and I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they did like a old man Steve Rogers where they had adults and did like a weird deep fake or something back then, but they actually look really good. I bought them as being in their, what would they be, mid-30s? They're a little bit too balding and a little bit too gray for mid-30s.
Right. They're 36 years old. I'm like, come on. You look better than that at 36.
I look better than that at 46.
I know they had to refilm this scene. They had to come back for reshoots. The original day they had King's Cross for this, they were rushed or something, or it's too much noise. They couldn't use the footage or didn't like the footage. They didn't get the coverage they wanted. So they filmed parts or all of this again. So maybe the makeup was even better this time. I didn't hear the makeup was bad the first time. I just heard they had to redo it because of issues out of their control or the time they had with the piece. But what I like very much about this scene is they kept the portion of the conversation with Harry and his young, nervous son. I don't like the kids' names. Albus Severus is kind of a mouthful. And Ginny's brother died. Why don't you name one of the kids Fred? Come on, something like that. But it just seems that one's James, one's Albus Severus, and the next one's Lily. I mean, it's kind of obvious. Just do something different. But minor complaint aside, I thought these scenes played extremely well. I liked the moment they acknowledge Malfoy, and we see he has a kid too. There's nothing wrong with this at all. I think Ron looks great. Hermione looks older. All of it plays so well, and I love how the camera zooms in on the three of them at the end. That's exactly what I wanted. I wanted all three of them in that frame, and we got that. It's a happily ever after moment, and I'm really glad this scene plays as well as I wanted it to.
It was schmaltzy. I didn't need it. I don't think it added to the story. I think you could have ended with the equivalent of the Ewok celebration on Endor with young Harry and young Hermione and young Ron. The one they aged up best was Ginny. Man, she did look, you know, I couldn't believe how well they did on that aging up. But the fact that they had these kids and named them these things, okay, it felt a little unnecessary to me, but I'm sure there's people who this is their favorite moment. It wasn't mine. It was a meh note to go out on after a really solid film.
I love the schmaltzy aspect of it, but I don't like the names. I like that we know that 19 years later, Hogwarts is still standing, life is back to normal, or Harry can have a normal life. All the subtext that's there implied with this scene, I enjoy.
Yeah, no sequel. It's not a tease for, like, the next one. Like, it's very clear by doing it this way, there will be no more.
It's funny you say that, Stuart, because this scene, verbatim, is the opening to Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So it actually is the start of the next adventure.
Yeah, but I don't know that they'll ever make a movie of that. We will cover it over at Books and Nachos.
So, Stuart, Arnie, do you recommend Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2? Stuart.
You know, I hated the book. I hated Part 1. But somehow I'm going to recommend Part 2, which is weird, I recognize. Why am I going to do it? Well, because it's essentially a fun movie. It really delivers this good climax, both in terms of action and some big emotional moments, many of which I think work better here on screen than they did on the page. And yeah, if you did stick this together with that first movie, I would say no thanks. I would say as a combined experience, no, this is not a good ending to the saga. But the filmmakers here have done a good job of extracting what worked from a deathly boring and poorly plotted book. And yeah, it's given it sort of a happy ending. So I can say mild recommend for some decent fantasy action, even though, yes, unfortunately, it's tied to a whole bunch of malarkey about quest upon quest.
Arnie.
Save the best for last. What a great note to go out on. This is my favorite Harry Potter film. It is full of action. It is pretty tight narratively. It is very well acted. You called out the score, Brock. I can't agree more. The score of this is really good. I like the score of the last one as well. Both of the Deathly Hallows films have good music, but I think this one just hits a little bit harder. It brings a very satisfying conclusion to a decade of movies. And I do still think that you could have merged Part 1 and Part 2 and still had a great movie, but unfortunately you had to suffer through Part 1 to get to this. Yeah, my favorite movie we've reviewed in this retrospective series. Happy to go out on a very high note. Solid recommend.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm definitely green arrowing this one. This was a lot of fun to watch. It came through. It nailed the landing. It certainly hit all the notes I needed to hit emotionally, action beats, character development-wise. We've talked about how these kids have been so good, and now that they're young adults, they are, I mean, goodness gracious, all of them have their moments. They're all doing great, and they have taken us all on this ride that ends with a very satisfactory climax to this series. I disagree with both of you, though. I think it would play very well and build very well if you have both these things smushed together as one long movie. If they had done that, there's definitely places we can cut, and we talked about that last episode. But I do think it works as one long movie for sure. I really, really do. You cannot watch Part 2, I don't think, not having watched Part 1, because it would make even less sense, in my opinion. But then again, do you need it to make sense plot-wise? Because most of this is some darn good action scenes and some fun character beats. If this is the only Harry Potter movie you've ever seen, which it shouldn't be, you'd be definitely confused. But would I return to this one without watching Part 1? Yeah, of course I could pop this one in. I can't say it's my favorite one, but I certainly enjoy it very much. And I'm very happy that they were able to bring so much of this book to screen. And I think it works really well with Part 1. So I'm very satisfied as a Harry Potter fan with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Arnie, you brought up this is your favorite Harry Potter movie. I would have to say still number 3 is my favorite Harry Potter movie for a lot of reasons we talked about on that podcast. And after that would be number 4. I think that's a really, really good adaptation. So 3 and 4 are my favorite of the movies in the series. Stuart, which one is your favorite of these 8 movies?
I agree with that. I think there are 2 good movies, 1 bad movie, and a whole lot in the middle. 3 and 4 are the good movies, and 7 is just terrible. But everything else, it had highs and lows. There were moments that worked. I would say 4, 3, 8, then take a pause. 2, 8-4-3-1-6-5-7.
And I would go 8-4-3-1-5-7-2-6.
Six is the worst.
Yeah, six.
Oof. Five is the bottom for me. I would go 3-4-8. Yeah, it's a tough one for me then after that.
We all agree 3, 4, and 8 are the tops, though.
Yeah, I think we all saw that as the highlights.
2 is lower than 7 for me, although 2 is, I've seen it more times, and 6 is fine, so yeah, probably 6 would come after that, then who knows? I just know that 5 is my least favorite movie for all the reasons we talked about before, but yeah, the top 3 are clear, far and away. Number 1 is completely watchable, and it's completely fine, and certainly be in the middle of the pack for this series, but honestly, I'm really happy that I got a chance to rewatch the entire series. It's really fun to watch it with my daughter, to someone else who knows these movies as well as I do, or even better, I should say. And it's kind of nice to share that with her at her age now, discussing the books and the movies with her as we go through. But I think the joy of all of it has been discussing it with you two. But this is not it. We've discussed the 7 Harry Potter books and the 8 Harry Potter movies, but we're not done with the Harry Potter universe quite yet.
And if you are a Platinum supporter, which is $35 via PayPal direct to us, or through Patreon and Podbean, $50 pledge, you can continue with the Wizarding World of Us as the Fantastic Beasts movies are reviewed over the next 3 weeks, ending with The Secrets of Dumbledore. I've seen the first of those films, and I'm interested in revisiting it.
I know nothing about it, but I'm just so happy there's not 700-page books to go along with it. These are originals. Rowling just wrote scripts, and so maybe I'll read those. Or just watch the movies.
I might watch the movie instead, but you're welcome to read the script and let us know how that went. I don't think I need that. I've only seen that first movie as well, and I'm the Harry Potter fan. Why haven't I watched the second movie? We will talk about that on our next podcast. But thanks again to all of you who have donated. We're greatly appreciative of it.
And if this is the end of your journey with us, thank you very much for your donation. Sincerely, I know I speak for all of us when I say how much I appreciate being able to do this. I have so much fun reviewing movies for this show, and I wouldn't be able to if it wasn't for you guys who support us. So thank you.
We will be back next week with Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But until then, mischief managed.
Now, if you two don't mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed, or worse, expelled.
She needs to sort out her priorities.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing.
I think that might have been the best moment of my life.
We hope you enjoyed the show.
But you loved that, didn't you, Potter?
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating.
You will find that help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask.
Go to booksandnachos.com each week to hear our hosts review the original novels on which these movies are based.
I didn't know you could read.
And come back to nowplayingpodcast.com next Tuesday for another all-new movie review podcast.
You'll stay with me
until the end.
Help us spread the word about this show by leaving a 5-star review on Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, or your podcast store of choice.
This is perhaps the most important memory I've collected.
Want more reviews like this one? In the archives section of nowplayingpodcast.com, you'll find more than 1,000 in-depth movie reviews from our panel of hosts.
Let's finish this the way we started it.
Together!
On our site, you can hear reviews for every installment in the world's biggest film franchises, including the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Star Wars, Spider-Man, Batman, X-Men, James Bond, Middle-Earth, Jurassic Park, Fast and Furious, and Transformers.
If you listen carefully enough, the past whispers to you.
Need more Now Playing? Subscribe to our In Focus weekly newsletter for exclusive digital download giveaways, celebrity interviews, behind-the-scenes insights, and more. Sign up through the subscribe page on our website and get it delivered to your inbox every Friday.
This is beyond anything I imagined.
You can also compare notes with us on Letterboxd. Go to letterboxd.com/nowplaying to see what our hosts are watching when we're not recording podcasts.
Every great wizard in history has started out as nothing more than what we are now. If they can do it, why not us?
And follow Now Playing on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our YouTube channel.
It is the quality of one's convictions that determines success, not the number of followers.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Do you know why I admire you? More perhaps than any man I know. You do not seek power or popularity. You simply ask, is a thing right?
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
His indispensable assistant.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
Has it ever crossed your brilliant mind that I don't want to do this anymore?
Whether it has or hasn't is irrelevant. You agreed. Nothing more to discuss.
Artwork by Joe, Justin, and Arnie.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
You're saying it wrong. It's Leviosa, not Leviosa.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Enganza Media Incorporated.
Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Dobby never meant to kill. Dobby only meant to maim or seriously injure.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Oh, you're gonna regret this. And your bloody chicken.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Sort of exciting, isn't it? Breaking the rules.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Let us hope that Mr. Potter will always be around to save the day.
Don't worry, I will be.
Ridiculous!
Ridiculous!
After each is destroyed, Voldemort will... Voldemort.
Voldemort. So much better than Voldemort.
Those prices keep dropping at Voldemort.
He has a blue skin special.
Ridiculous!
And I had mentioned earlier that someone was replaced a couple of episodes ago. Here, we have Blaze and Goyle instead of Crab and Goyle. There's the actor who played Crab was arrested for marijuana possession or something. So he was not asked back.
So because Crab blazed, we get Blaze and Goyle.
Yes. I like that joke better than the dentist one, just on the record.
I've been sitting on that Blaze joke for 5 movies.
Ridiculous!
Ridiculous!
I don't care. I think the memories of Snape also play very, very well. And my daughter made a funny comment. When we see the scenes when Snape goes to Dumbledore, soon after when Lily dies or something, she said, well, that shouldn't be him. The other Dumbledore should be in these flashback scenes here. And then this Dumbledore should be later on because obviously Richard Harris was replaced. But I thought that was kind of funny that she made that joke, and I thought it would be funny to repeat it here, and apparently you guys did not find that funny. Okay, but I thought that was cute that she pointed out that it's a different Dumbledore.
It goes right there with my dentist joke on the cutting room floor.
But she's 12, and you're not.
Ridiculous!